Come speak to this group again. It's been a while. For those of you who don't know who I am, Jeff Bensinger, my wife Yvonne, actually my daughter Jill is with us, and we're up traveling this weekend for a family outing on Yvonne's side. Her mother actually turns 90 tomorrow, so we're kind of getting together, the whole family, and her brothers and sisters are coming from out of state, and so looking forward to that. The topic I'm going to be talking about today is something I've been studying on now for about, I would say, 7 months or maybe even 8 months. And I think I know what I'm talking about, so I'm going to present it, but I want feedback, and I want this to be open, so please feel free to jump in and make comments and things. I think you will find it interesting and fascinating, and it's just kind of a different paradigm shift from probably what most of us have thought. So, as you know, most of us should know that one of our positions that's talked about in Scripture is that we are supposed to be priests. We're supposed to be a priesthood of Elohim. And I'm going to be talking about the topic I'm going to be talking about is the Book of the Covenant versus the Book of the Law. And it's returning to Israel's destiny as priests. So we are grafted into Israel, right? We're part of Israel. And part of our role is to be as priests. So we know that there's many New Testament scriptures that talk about that. 1 Peter 2, I'm going to be turning around a lot because I'm going to be reading off there. 1 Peter 2 and several spots in the book of Revelation says that we are to be priests of Elohim. One verse that you're probably in particular is in 1 Peter 2, 9 and 10 says, but you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, as a people for Elohim's own possession to proclaim the virtues of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of Elohim. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. So he's saying that we are supposed to be a priesthood, but you got to remember who he's talking to here, because especially in verse 10, he's basically reiterating what was spoken in the book of Hosea about Israel, the northern 10 tribes that went into dispersion. But now they're being brought back because of Messiah. But this very same verse, or very similar to this, we find in Exodus 19, 5 and 6. When the children of Israel came to Mount Sinai, this is exactly, or very similar language, that he said to Israel. So weren't the Israelites already the priests? And what happened? I think somewhat superficially we know what happened in terms of, because of the golden calf incident, then the tribe of Levi became the priests. Okay? And it says, in Exodus there, he says, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests or an holy nation. I wanted to go back to 1 Peter again. In the Aramaic, I like the Aramaic in this, because it says, but you are an elect race officiating as priests for the kingdom. That's supposed to be our role, not future. That's supposed to be our role now. So what happened? The Israelites were supposed to be a nation, a holy nation, set aside a priesthood. And now we're supposed to be that again. But what happened in the middle? And what transpired? And we're going to look at it scripturally to give you information that's going to help explain, I think, a lot of the scriptures that we find in the New Testament that may have been difficult to understand in the past. It also should give us a view as our role as priests. So I'm going to go through, as I go through this, again, I want it to be interactive, but I'm going to be asking some questions. A couple of you have already been highlighted to this a little bit, so let the others answer if you would. So my first question is, how many covenants did Yahweh make with ancient Israel from the time they arrived at Mount Sinai until the time they went into the Promised Land? How many covenants did he make with them? Or covenant? Anybody? It's okay. You can jump out. You made one? Okay, we got one. Anybody else? One, two. Who said two? You got two? Okay. Anybody more than two? Okay. So, to answer that, let's go to a scripture. And we find the scripture in Deuteronomy 29, verse 1. And it's kind of a key scripture. Because he says, these are the words of the covenant which Yahweh commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab. Now, where's Moab? Moab is just before they were getting ready to enter into the Promised Land. Moses wasn't able to cross, but they're right there, and he's making the covenant with the children of Israel in the land of Moab. But then it goes on to say, beside the covenant which he made with them in Horeb, or at Mount Sinai. So if I said, I handed you a 50-cent piece, and I had one in my pocket, and I says, I gave you the 50-cent piece beside the one I have in my pocket, how many is that?
Two.
Two. Okay. Now, I think most of us, at least I know I have, in the past, thought, well, he made the covenant with them at Mount Sinai. Yes, they sinned, but before, and then all the people 40, you know, 20 and above died off, and then just before they went to the Promised Land, he reinstituted the same covenant. Sometimes Deuteronomy is called a retelling or a reissuing of the law. Okay. But what we're going to see is that there's differences between those two. Important differences. And then with that, it's going to help, as I mentioned, to explain a lot of the scriptures we see in the New Testament. We're talking about the Book of the Covenant and the Book of the Law. The Book of the Covenant is actually only mentioned in Scripture three times. Once in Exodus 24, what we're going to see is where the initial covenant he made with them at Mount Sinai.
Just a quick question. You mentioned two covenants. So which one's considered the old one?
The old one as in...
The old covenant versus the new covenant.
No, not... You're saying old and new, using new, but the first covenant he made with them at Mount Sinai, yeah. And then the second covenant he made with them at Moab. Okay, so the first covenant is the Book of the Covenant. The second one is the Book of the Law.
Okay, so you're making a difference between the two.
Yes, and like I said, most of us have thought, well, these are the same thing. But we're going to see it's not. So there's three spots in the Book of the Covenant that's actually mentioned in Scripture. Then there's several spots, especially as you see at the end of the Book of Deuteronomy and the first part into Joshua, where the Book of the Law is mentioned. Also, many times you see it mentioned as the Law of Moses, especially in the New Testament. Okay, that's referring to the Book of the Law. But the Book of the Covenant, mentioned three times. So, let's look at the Book of the Covenant and the initial covenant that Yahweh makes with Israel at Mount Sinai. So, beginning in Exodus 19, he makes the initial proposal. So, this is kind of following a pattern that you can see throughout Scripture about how covenants are made. And I think I know Jeff's talked about this in the past. So he gives them an initial proposal. If you'll do this, you'll be my people. You'll follow my laws. You'll be my people. They give an initial acceptance, and then they get sanctified. They go and do their washing. Okay? Exodus 20. He starts speaking the Ten Commandments. And then the people request, I don't want to hear Yahweh's voice. He makes them stop, so Moses goes back up. And what we see in Exodus 21 through 23 are the other judgments, the other civil codes, the appointed times, okay, the Shemitah year, the seven-year cycle. All those are given in Exodus 21 through 23. Things like the bondservant in Exodus 21. Those things are part of the Book of the Covenant, the initial covenant that he makes with them. And let's remember, basically what he's doing here is reiterating or giving to Israel the agreement that he's already made with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and now is giving to them. We get to Exodus 24. It's really only maybe the first 11 verses of Exodus 24. You have the post-acceptance, a final acceptance. They actually kill the bullocks. They put the blood on the altar. He sprinkles the blood on the people. And they say, all that he has said, we will do. And then we have the covenant-confirming meal. And you remember, that's when Moses and Aaron and the 70 elders went up and had the meal with Yahweh. So here is all the steps of the covenant, the proposal, the acceptance, the blood ratification, because it's a blood covenant, and they're accepting it, and then a confirming meal. Those are the steps that you find in Scripture on a covenant being issued and being ratified. So that takes us up to about halfway through Exodus 24. So my question is, so if the covenant is made and ratified, what is the rest of Exodus through Deuteronomy? Why do we have the rest of that? Galatians 3:15 says, and Paul speaking here says, brethren, I speak after the manner of men. Though it be a man's covenant, yet if it be confirmed, no man disannulleth or addeth to. So we see up through Exodus 19 through 24, we have a ratified covenant. You can't add to or take away from it. So what is the rest of Exodus through Deuteronomy? Deuteronomy 4:2 talks about, again, you should not add to or take away from the word. This is a common theme, even in Judaism. It's also cited at the end of the book of Revelation about not adding to or taking away from the words of this book. So, what is the rest then of the five books after Exodus 24? Again, the Deuteronomy 4:2, you not add to or take away. So my question is it a change to Torah to enact a change that's in Torah? Does that make sense? Is it wrong? You can't add to or take away. You can't change anything. But if there's a change that's built into Torah, is that wrong then? It's part of the Torah. There's going to be a change in the future. Genesis 49:10 begins the beginning of this. And you'll remember, this is at the time where Joseph is speaking to all the sons, and he gets to Judah, and he says, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. So the king the kingship is going to be in Judah until Messiah comes. Then that's going to change. Now, you may think, well, Yeshua was part of Judah. He was from the tribe of Judah. But where is his kingship and what is his priesthood? We know from the book of Hebrews that he is a Melchizedek priest. Okay? And the Melchizedek, that title, it's a title, it's not a name. Melchizedek in the Hebrew just means righteous king or righteous ruler or king of righteousness. So the kingship that had been with Judah until Shiloh came now is changed. It's in Torah that the change would happen. In the future that was going to occur. Hebrews 7:11 through 16. We see in the New Testament several spots where this is also confirmed. And I'm not going to read all of this just for time. You can put it in your notes and go back and look at it. So if therefore perfection was by the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what law is he talking about? There was no Levitical priesthood when they did the covenant at Mount Sinai. The Levitical priesthood didn't exist yet. It didn't happen until after we had the golden calf incident. And then the tribe of Levi became the priest, and specifically Aaron and his sons became the high priest to do the sacrifices. So when we see this scripture in the New Testament, for under it the people received the law, which law are we talking about? It has to be this book of the law that was later added. Then it says, for the priesthood being changed, why was that changed? So we had a Levitical priesthood, but it was changed to what?
Shiloh
came. So now we're under a Melchizedek priesthood. So for the priesthood being changed, there also is a necessity of a change also in the law. So Shiloh came. Do we need what was added for the Levitical priesthood and the sacrifices and the things associated with that? We don't any longer, because Messiah is now our high priest. Messiah is now our ruler. And he's not of the Levitical priesthood, as it talks about in Hebrews. So, again, this is this idea that are we really changing Torah if it's a change that's built into Torah? Again, I'm not going to go through all of this. Hebrews 9, 1 through 10, again, talks about divine service, again, the Levitical priesthood things. But at the end, it says, which stood only in meats and drinks and divers washings and cardinal ordinances imposed on them until the time of Reformation. Notice it says imposed upon them. If you look at the covenant, the book of the law covenant that was made with Israel in the book of Deuteronomy, remember at Mount Sinai, they accepted it. They said, all that Yahweh has said, we will do and obey. They don't make that statement in Deuteronomy. It's imposed upon them because of the sin of the golden calf and other things that happened. Now they're imposed with a covenant that's basically for life. Because, and we'll see this in a little bit, remember what happened after the golden calf incident. Yahweh wanted to wipe them all out and start over with Moses. And Moses interceded and said, no, don't do that. So instead of wiping them all out, he places upon them now this Levitical priesthood and these other laws.
John, the way you just phrased that took me right back to when Adam and Eve sinned. He said, because of this now, you're going to be banished from the garden and then imposed upon them. You know, Adam, you're going to have to work, you know, the soil.
Sweat of your brow, thorns and thistles.
Eve, you're going to experience pain through the delivery of
and
children.
What happens? What do we see at the end of the book of Revelation? We get back to communing with Elohim in his garden or in his place, in his holy place, yeah. So my next question is, where was Yahweh's covenants made with ancient Israel? And we kind of already talked about that. One was made at Mount Sinai or in Horeb. The other one in the land of Moab. Okay? Made in two different places. What animals was or were sacrificed when Yahweh's covenant with ancient Israel was made? This is kind of interesting. In the Sinai covenant, Exodus 24, verses 5 through 8, it says, and he sent young men of the children of Israel, which offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen unto Yahweh. And Moses took half of the blood, put it in a basin, and half the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And he took the book of the covenant. This is one of the three places. So all the words that Yahweh had given him, he wrote down into a book. And he read it out loud in the audience of the people, and they said, all that Yahweh hath said, we will do and be obedient. And Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold, the blood of the covenant, which Yahweh has made with you concerning all these words. So this is the blood covenant, the ratification of that. They're accepting it, and they're sprinkled with the blood of the covenant. In Moab, and notice my question was, what animals were sprinkled or offered? It says there was burnt offerings and peace offerings of oxen. But when we get to Moab, it says, for when Moses had spoken every precept to the people according to law, he took the blood of calves and goats with water, scarlet wool, and hyssop, and sprinkled both the book and the people. Now notice, in the Sinai covenant, he didn't sprinkle the book. But here he does. And the people, saying, this is the blood of the testament which Elohim has enjoined unto you. Okay? He's placing this upon them. Moreover, he sprinkled with blood both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry. Well, yeah. Here we have a tabernacle. We have a Levitical Aaronic ministry with the utensils and the things that they were to use. That didn't exist at Mount Sinai. That stuff didn't exist yet. And where was the covenant Yahweh made with ancient Israel placed? But what? There's two. So, we know from here in 1 Kings 8 and 9, it says, there was nothing in the ark except the two stone tablets Moses had placed in at Horeb, the tablets of the covenant. So remember, after they have the meal and stuff, he goes back up the mountain for the 40 days, and he's given the two tablets. And then he comes back down, and they're sitting with the golden calf. He smashes them, but then we get two more tablets, and those are put in the ark. There's no reference anymore that I can find. I'd be glad if somebody could show me. Why would we have the stones when Moses wrote it out in a book or a scroll? And what happened to that? We don't know. I mean, it isn't talked about.
Wasn't the scroll also placed in the ark?
Yeah. Deuteronomy 31:26. Take this book of the law, the second covenant, and put it by the side of the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh your Elohim, that it may be there for a witness against you. So the Ten Commandments, I found this handy little sort of diagram. As you can see, the commandment, the Ten Commandments, or the covenant that was made at Mount Sinai, the tablets were put inside the Ark. It's called the Ark of the Covenant. But the Book of the Law is placed outside. And it's there for a witness against you. So that brings to me in mind some scriptures in the New Testament about the writings that were against you. So one of them was placed in the Ark of the Covenant, the Book of the Covenant, and one was placed outside the Ark. When Yahweh was made the covenant, who or what was sprinkled? We kind of talked about that already with the two different covenants. Different things were sprinkled in both cases. It was a little bit different. But again, I want to emphasize this Moab covenant. It says, this is the blood of the testament which Elohim hath enjoined upon you. And this word enjoined in the Greek comes from these strong numbers, 1781, and so on. It means to order, to command to be done, to enjoin. I always like it when they define the word with a version of the word, but that's what it is. So the covenant at Moab was enjoined upon them. Unlike the covenant at Mount Sinai, where they said, all that you have said we will do and we will obey. So again, we're seeing there's these differences between these two covenants. And there's all kinds of differences between what was in them, where they were placed, what was sprinkled in each of the covenants, and the fact that one was a covenant in the sense that the parties agreed to it, the other one, it was enjoined upon them. Now we know that the Levites, the sons of Aaron, became the priests of Israel after the golden calf incident. Okay? It's interesting that they transitioned from a nation of priests to a nation with priests. Who were the priests in Scripture and in Israel before that? Before the Levites and Aaron, who were the priests?
The nation.
Okay. And do we have any other references? Yeah, before Mount Sinai, do we see any other references to the priests? So Exodus 19, 5 through 6, like we just mentioned, the whole nation was supposed to be a king of priests. But if you go on down in 19, verse 22, where he's talking about not letting the people come up onto the mount, he says, and let the priests also, which come near to Yahweh, sanctify themselves, lest Yahweh break forth upon them. Well, who were those priests?
The elders,
the firstborn. Verse 24, and Yahweh said unto him, get thee down, and thou shalt come up, thou and Aaron, with thee, but let not the priest and the people break through to come up to Yahweh, lest he break forth upon them. So again, who are these priests? Again, this idea that the priesthood was changed, I would argue, is really just a change back to what it was. Before the incident at Mount Sinai, where the Levitical priests were put in place, he's now reverting us back to Yeshua as the Melchizedek priest, and if we're supposed to be priests, What priesthood are we of? Have you ever asked yourself that? Are we Levitical priests?
No.
Can't be. Unless you're from the tribe of Levi. So, what other priesthood does that leave? And it really only relieves the Melchizedek priesthood. Numbers 3, 12 through 13 says, "And I behold, I have taken the Levites from among the children of Israel instead of all of the firstborn, open the matrix among the children of Israel. Therefore, the Levites shall be mine, because all the firstborn are mine. For on that day I smote all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. I held unto me all the firstborn in Israel, both man and beast. Mine shall they be, I am Yahweh." Remember what happened after we got the Levitical priesthood. The firstborn, now you had to redeem, you had to pay a fee. And that went to help support the Levites. Because they were taking the place of the firstborn, who were the priests. If you just think back through Scripture, even back to Cain and Abel, they were giving offerings, right? Noah, when he comes off the ark, he does burnt sacrifices. Abraham, same thing. The heads of families, the leadership, acted in that role of priests. I mean, even if you get to the thought of what happened at the Passover in Egypt. Okay, who killed the lambs? The heads of the households, right? But later, in the Torah, under the Levitical priesthood, they didn't get to kill their lambs anymore. They had to take them up to the priests, and they would slaughter them, put the blood on the altar, then they took them back and cooked them. So that role of the priesthood was taken away from them, given to Levites, until Messiah would come and fix the situation and bring us back to the role that we were supposed to have. I spoke a little bit about the feast last year about this. I'm just going to go over this really quick. 2 Peter 2:5 talks about Noah and says, "Noah, the eighth person preacher of righteousness." Now, the word "person" there I have shown is in italics. If you look in your King James, it's in italics, which means what? It was added. It's not in the original. So, Noah the eighth, and probably the punctuation wasn't in the original Hebrew either. I don't think they had punctuation in Hebrew. Noah the eighth person, or the eighth, a preacher of righteousness. Now, the Jewish tradition is, you talk about Melchizedek. Our background has always been that Melchizedek was a pre-incarnate version of Messiah. Okay, but that's not what the Jews teach. That's not a lot of what ancient writings like the Book of Jasher, some of those types of writings, they say that Melchizedek was Shem. Again, Melchizedek is not a name, it's a title. And so, if Noah, the eighth preacher of righteousness, okay, so here's the lineage from Adam down. And we see that Noah is actually the tenth person in terms of descendancy from Adam. But Adam was the first priest, right? He was supposed to have rulership over the earth. He was supposed to turn people to Yahweh. Obviously, in the garden, he had issues there. But then it goes to Seth, to Enos, Canaan, Mahalalel, to Jared. But from Jared, remember, Enoch is translated. While Jared's still alive. So it jumps from Mahalalel, or I'm sorry, from Jared to Methuselah, because he's still there. And from Methuselah, Lamech, his son, dies before he does. In fact, dies about, if you believe the what's laid out in Scripture, in the book of Genesis, he dies about 5 years before his father. Methuselah dies actually right before the flood. And so for Methuselah, it goes to Noah. So that's how you can have 10 generations, but only 8 priests. So what happened from there? We know, at least if by the Jewish tradition, it goes from Moses or from Noah to Shem. From Shem, it goes on down to Abraham, goes to Isaac, to Jacob, to Joseph, and then we pick up Moses. And think about what Moses did. He acted in the role of a priest. First, in Exodus 3, this is where he's tending the sheep for his father-in-law Jethro, and he goes up onto the mountain, and Yahweh gives him the assignment to go back to get his people out of Egypt. Exodus 19, the whole house of Jacob is called priests. Exodus 32, I mentioned earlier, when they had the golden calf incident, and he wants to wipe them all out. What happens? Moses intercedes. What is Messiah doing now as our high priest? He's at the right hand of the Father interceding for us, right? Interceding is one of those roles that as a priest, they do. We should be doing. So, in my humble opinion, I think that Moses is the last of Melchizedek priests until Messiah. Because then we have the Levitical priesthood from there. We know that the Levites and the sons of Aaron became the priests after the golden calf incidents, and tithes and offerings were overseen by them. Who did that before? Well, we see one incident where Abraham gives it to Melchizedek. What about the offerings? We talked about the heads of the households, the leaders of the families did their own offerings. Abraham, Noah, Cain and Abel, all the way down through the line, did the offerings. What about tithes? Okay, but who overseen that? Who? Where was that done? This is a conversation I was having with Todd over the phone the other morning. There's two examples of tithing prior to the Levitical priesthood. The example with Abraham giving a tithe to Melchizedek, and then there's an example with Jacob where he says, you know, because if you'll bless me, then I will give you a tithe of everything I own. Now, arguably, you could say, okay, I don't see a command there. They must have known how to do that for some reason, somehow. But we really don't see a command until we get to the time of the Levite priesthood. That's how they were supported, because they didn't have land. This is one of those issues I'm kind of still fleshing out, because we do know that in the Book of the Covenant, the holy days, the appointed times, were given. And so how would you be able to keep those appointed times unless you somehow set aside monies to do that, right? And even in the New Testament, giving is talked about lots of times. Not maybe formally in the sense of a tithe, but maybe even more than a tithe. But I mean, it's different than what we have known, and I'm still not totally fixed on that either way. Yeah, but right.
come up, but I might have bored to go there.
Exactly. So somehow, so does that mean you have to set aside a tithe? I don't know. It also says in Malachi that you have robbed me from tithes, right? But remember, they were still under the book of the law at that point, which included the Levitical priest and which included the requirement to tithe to support them. Again, that's one of those ones that I... So I mentioned there what happens after Exodus 24, about halfway through and through the rest till the end of the book of Deuteronomy. There's probably a good time to talk about that, because in that whole section, there's lots of stuff that's included in the Book of the Covenant that's talked about again. We know Leviticus 23 talks about the holy days, but that's a Book of the Covenant issue. The Sabbath is talked about. There's lots of things that are Book of the Covenant things that are also mentioned in the Book of the Law. So the things that were added as we're looking at some of those scriptures are what? The Levitical priesthood, those extra offerings and washings and all those things that they did. Now, are they valuable? What did Paul say to Timothy? He said, all scripture is beneficial for doctrine, for reproof. So if we're to be priests, are there things there that he's setting us an example to show us how to act as priests? It's not like that goes away, but it's more of an administration thing. We're no longer under a Levitical priesthood. But is that part of Torah beneficial? Absolutely. There's things for us to glean from that. There's things and lessons for us to learn.
So I have a question. In Zechariah, when the offerings are sacrificed or instituted, if there's no Levitical priesthood, who's going to receive it? You're talking about the Melchizedek priesthood.
Well,
you know what I'm talking about.
And so you also look in the book of Ezekiel in chapters 40 through 46, where it talks about a millennial thing, and it says the sons of Zadok. Zadok was the high priest at the time of David and Solomon, and that the sons of Zadok would administer in the tabernacle or at the temple. Okay, so think about that word, that name Zadok, though. Zadok comes from the same three Hebrew letter root as Zadik, which means righteous. So when we think about the Melchizedek priest, just because he says there that the sons of Zadok will administer to me, can they be part of the Melchizedek priesthood also? Just because they were Levites doesn't mean they can't be part of that.
Well, it's more the administrative change, not the individual.
Right.
So they can still be part of that.
Exactly, yeah. It's interesting that the priesthood, the Torah portion for last week, if you followed Torah portions, was the one where Balak came in and they were trying to get the Israelites to sin, with the donkey and all that stuff. We were talking about it in our fellowship last Sabbath. Who was the Messiah picture? Almost every Torah portion you'll see a Messiah picture. And who was the Messiah picture in that? Is Phinehas. Because Phinehas is the grandson of Aaron, and he's the one that goes in with the javelin and runs through the Israelite and the woman who he was fornicating with. And he stood up for his law. And actually it says there that Phinehas will have a covenant of peace. He and his descendants will have a covenant of peace. Well, where's that coming from? Obviously that's Messiah. That's talking about Messiah that's going to be given to him. But Zadok is the descendant directly from Phinehas. And it's through Zadok and his line is where the priesthood, the Levitical priesthood, came from when we get down into the New Testament. That's where we see it's descendants of Zadok. So your question about when we get to Zechariah 4, Zechariah talking about keeping the feast, I think you're going to have that, but there'll be a priesthood there. What's it going to look like? I can only speculate at this point, right? So.
No, I mean, God wanted us to know.
Yeah, Jeff.
Well, I
this verse picked up because I was going to ask you that, because it says, these are the descendants of Zadok, who alone among the descendants of Levi may come near to the Eternal to minister to him. Mm-hmm. This is out of Ezekiel 40, 45, 46, 47.
Right.
So am I hearing you say they can be both? Because it specifically says they alone out of Levi. So it's very specific that Levi is still involved in the administration of the temple.
So those out of Levi will be priests. Does that mean others can't be?
It says, who alone among the descendants may come near me? So
okay.
It's very specific. He had to be a descendant of Levi, and only of those descendants.
But you're reading that specific to say, those are the only ones. That, could you read it to say that only the sons of Zadok, of all the Levites, are the ones who can come before me?
Right.
I don't know.
No, that's what it's saying. But it's specific about Levi.
Right.
Ezekiel
what?
40, 46, 47, 48.
Yeah. So that's a good question. I don't know. I know we're going to be keeping the feast in the future. The appointed times are a Book of the Covenant issue. Yes, they're mentioned in the Book of the Law, but they're a Book of the Covenant issue that existed prior even, I think, prior to Mount Sinai. But certainly were given then. Yes.
So, the question I was going to have,
Aaron,
took the mic away.
Good job,
Aaron. Do you feel that because this is very specific to some prophecies that Yahweh made about Israel and gathering them, and you get the, you know, Valley of Dry Bones and all that, that there will be a Levitical priesthood at the same time there will be Melchizedek and priesthood?
All I know is Messiah is Melchizedek priest.
Right.
And
we
if we are priests,
priests of
from
Messiah,
I would say we are of that priesthood. I do know that besides that scripture, I think there's another scripture that talks that I make up, I don't know if it's an everlasting or a perpetual covenant with the Levites, that they will always serve me.
Right, because again, the prophecies that it's talking about are very specific to the resurrected house of Israel.
Yeah, so I'll answer first, I don't know, and secondly, with a question, which makes it even better. So, if take a look at the book of Ezekiel. This is like a whole other thing, okay? The book of Ezekiel is made up of or comprised of 13 scrolls. And the way they're listed right now in the Masoretic text, they're not in chronological order. And so, and you've spoken about this, and I've spoken about this, that there's different levels of meaning to everything we read, multiple levels of meaning. So if you look at Ezekiel and put it in chronological order, some argue that that was not a millennial view of things, but that Ezekiel was speaking to, because Ezekiel was part of the groups out of Judah that went into captivity in Babylon, but they were only located about 100 miles or so from where many of the descendants of the northern tribes were at. And he actually prophesies to them and goes and talks with them. And so some have speculated that this is actually speaking of them turning back to Yahweh, both houses, and returning back so that the sons of Zadok are in a priesthood there. I know we've always looked at that, and I think most people look at it as a millennial setting. Just another thought. Anyways. All right. Sorry. Got off track. So I wanted to go through a few scriptures. We've talked about a few of these already. But troublesome scriptures, I would say, is I'm using that as a connotation, that I think are somewhat clarified by this idea that the Book of the Covenant and the Book of the Law are two separate things. So I think we talked about this one a little bit. It says, if therefore perfection were by the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what law are we talking about? It has to be the book of the law. It can't be the book of the covenant, because under the book of the covenant there wasn't any Levitical priesthood. It didn't exist until later, after the golden calf incident. So what's being written here is he's referring to the book of the law. Because it says, therefore, if perfection was by the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law. It was the book of the law that was received under the Levitical priesthood. There was no Levitical priesthood at Mount Sinai. Galatians 3:17-18. And I put some numbers in here for a reason. One of the authors, so I'm going to show you some books here where some of this is coming from, I thought helped clarify this. Galatians 3:17-18, Paul's writing, says, "In this I say that the covenant," this is going to be talking about the Abrahamic covenant, which was then offered again to Israel at Mount Sinai, "that was confirmed before Elohim in Messiah, the law," book of the law, "which was 430 years after, cannot disannul that it should make the promise of none effect." I've got promise as number three. So the covenant number one, which contains the promise, can't be disannulled by the law. Then he goes on in verse 18, "For if the inheritance," what inheritance are we talking about? "The one promised to Abraham. And that we, through Messiah, get the promises given to Abraham," right? "For if the inheritance be of the law, it is no more of a promise. But Elohim gave it to Abraham by a promise." So the covenant, and we're talking here the covenant that he made with Abraham, both in Genesis 12 and then finalized in Genesis 15. You remember the walking through the pieces? That's the covenant he made with Abraham. And what did he tell Abraham? He's going to give him all the land from the river in Egypt to the river Euphrates, that his people would be like the sand on the seashore, or the stars in the heavens.
And
shall be blessed, right, eventually, because Messiah comes, right? So the law can't disannul that. The book of the covenant is the inheritance, or the answer to the promised covenant made in Genesis 15. The inheritance covenant, or the book of the covenant, along with the promise made in 15, are not part of the book of the law. So the covenant he made with Abraham, he extended to the Israelites at Mount Sinai. And they accepted that, and they entered into that covenant. But then, with the incident of the golden calf, all that was done, set aside. But what does Yeshua do when he comes? He reestablishes that covenant and makes it even better not as a Levitical priest, but as a Melchizedek priest. And he allows us and all those who turn to him to have access to the covenant made with Abraham.
I have a question.
Yep.
And regarding Abraham, during that incident or that event where Abram cut in pieces the doves and what, and in that situation,
didn't cut the birds, he cut the animals.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yep.
Right. It was God who said, "I am promising to do this," right?
Abraham didn't walk between the
Correct.
Pieces.
It was
so,
God.
So I think, so there's a couple of,
well, right, there might
couple
be some
of speculations here, because there's two things that went between the pieces, right?
Yes.
there was a burning lamp or burning coal, and also, what was the other, the torch, or I don't know what the other thing. Well, there was actually two things that went between. But Abraham certainly didn't go between.
Right. Well, the point I was making was that there was a divine participation in that walk. But in the covenant of Mount Sinai, it was the people who said, whatever you say, we will do. So they're the ones in that covenant saying, we're going to do it.
Right.
In that case, it was God promising to Abraham. I'm just saying there's, I don't know if there's a big difference to it, but.
Well, so he made the promise to Abraham, but as part of the promise to Abraham, he said, you know, that he would give to his descendants also. So now we're coming out of Israel, or coming out of Egypt 430 years later, and now he's bringing them back to remembrance of the covenant that he gave to Abraham, including going into the promised land, including being his people, being a priesthood, all those things that Abraham kind of was already doing. But the point there is that the Book of the Covenant, yes, it's specific to Exodus 19 through 24, but in reality, it's really from the beginning of Genesis 1 through. Because the things like the holy days and the things that are talked about there are represented all prior, even before that, to Abraham, and then later then to the Israelites. Those are the things of the Book of the Covenant. But not the things that we see in the Book of the Law that were added. There's from Exodus 24 to Deuteronomy, we see a lot of the Book of the Covenant issues. It talks about, as I mentioned earlier, it talks about the holy days. It talks about the Sabbath. It talks about lots of things. One of the couple of things I'm still trying to figure out which side of the ledger they fall on. What about the Nazirite vow? Nazirite vow was given, wasn't specifically listed in the Book of the Covenant. But we do see Paul in the Book of Acts, after Messiah has come, doing a Nazirite vow with four companions. So, I mean, you could argue, well, that's part of the Book of the Law because that's in the context of where it was given, but what is it? It's setting yourself aside to be holy unto the Most High. I see examples of that all through Genesis up till that. Yes.
Where does Matthew 5:17 and 18 fit in then?
Matthew 5:17, yeah, that don't think that I've come to do away with the Torah, the law. I've come to fulfill it. Again, I think
it's not one jot of one tittle will pass from the law
until the law be fulfilled. Heaven and earth will not pass away. Okay, so I agree.
So are you saying then?
But does that
the implication is that it's fulfilled and no longer binding?
I think it goes back to the statement, it's not a change in the law if the change is built into the law. If it was said from the beginning that once Messiah comes, there's until Messiah comes, or you know, as it says there in Genesis 49, until Shiloh comes. Well, until means we're going to do this until, and then there's going to be something different.
So what does that mean, though? Does that mean...
I think all of the Torah is still applicable up to the point of the part of the Book of the Law I don't think is applicable anymore because we're not under Levitical priesthood anymore. The Levitical priesthood was added, I'm going to get to that in a second, but it was added for a reason, very specific reason, because of transgressions, right? If we're going back to what was before that... to me, that's all built into Torah.
I'm not disputing whether the change was built in, but the application in today's world to say, stop reading as binding obligations at Exodus 24:7.
No, because there's a lot of things, as I mentioned, from Exodus 24 on to the Book of Deuteronomy that talks you know, the appointed times are mentioned in that Exodus 19 to Exodus 24, but a lot more details given to them in Leviticus 23. Okay, those are Book of the Covenant issues. The Sabbath, there's more definition.
But when it's not referenced in the Book of the Covenant, I guess is the issue.
Yeah, I'm looking at these. Right there, that was given under the Book of the Covenant. But then I also see the scriptures that talk about the prophecy that Messiah would be wearing them, the healing that the woman received when she touched the hem of his garment, that in the Hebrew, she touched his tzitzits. I have to say, okay, is that a Book of the Law issue or is it a Book of the Covenant issue? I'm not sure. I'm still wrestling with some of these myself.
Then the challenge is, are we just talking semantics if nothing has changed?
Well, certainly we're not under Levitical priesthood and the things that go with that. But we kind of already knew that, right?
Right.
Before any of this, we already kind of knew that.
But I guess the challenge
is... But what I was trying to point out here is how did we get from where they were at Mount Sinai to where we are now? And how did we... through Scripture, did Yahweh return us as part of Israel back to what their destiny was as being priests?
Okay. Because then there's a different discussion of then how does that apply now in what we do?
Well... Yeah. I mean, you and I were talking earlier about if we're supposed to be priests, as the Aramaic version of that verse said, priests for the kingdom, that doesn't mean we wait until the millennium.
Right.
That means we should be doing some priestly things right now. And so we have to figure out what does it mean to be a priest, and that's why I said, just because we're not under a Levitical priesthood doesn't mean we don't see things in that Levitical priesthood that are helpful for us to learn how to administer as priests. Maybe you would say on a spiritual level. Galatians 3:19, another one of those verses. Wherefore then serveth the book of the law? It was added because of transgressions until the seed should come to whom the promise was made. Another one of those until verses. The law was added. What law? The book of the law, I would argue. I put in parentheses. Until the seed should come until the promises were made and it was ordained by angels in the hand of a mediator. Okay.
With individuals who don't believe, they get the terminology mixed up, the covenant, the old covenant, the new covenant, this is the new covenant, what was done away with, and it's, I think I'm beginning to understand what you're saying. I'm still not clear how it applies, but there is one thing where it definitely does apply, is where what God said in Jeremiah, this is the new, I mean specifically, this is the new covenant I will write. I will write my Torah in your hearts and minds. So are we defining Torah differently here? Because, as you know, Hebrews repeats that.
Right.
I will write the Torah in your hearts and minds. So none of it can be, not one jot or tittle will be till heaven and earth pass away, but I will write it. So that specific thing. So are you saying there are two different things?
I'm saying that the Book of the Covenant written. And the Book of the Law is two different things. And so the New Covenant is getting us back to a covenant that's similar to what was given to Abraham, similar to what was offered to the Israelites at Mount Sinai, not the Book of the Law that was added. Let me just get through a couple more slides
okay, that's
here,
fine.
And we'll come back to this.
Well, we don't have to. I don't want to. If I'm the only one interested in it, I don't want to include everybody in that. So.
What's that? Okay, well, we're going to come right back to this, because maybe this will help.
Sure.
Okay, until the seed should come. Okay, so I'm asking here, is Paul saying that the law was added to the law because of the transgression of the law? Or if you want to put Torah in there, the Torah was added to the Torah because of the transgression of the Torah. It has to be two different things. It doesn't even make sense. I want to go back to this Galatians 3:19. It says, "Wherefore then serveth the law? It was added because of transgressions until the seed should come." That word "added" is interesting. It's translated from the Greek word, and don't ask me, who's our Greek people? Prosthetemi? Something like that. It's where we get our English word prosthetic or prosthesis. So, if you put that in there, it says, "Wherefore then serveth the law?" It was a prosthetic because of the transgressions. What transgression? The golden calf incident. So the golden calf incident, when they sinned, you could almost say it was like a bomb going off. And they needed a prosthetic to help aid them until Messiah would come and repair.
They mean the entire Sinai, everything that happened, not just at Sinai, but everything that happened after that, all of it, everything that was added, everything, the Ten Commandments, everything. Because I've heard people say that before, and that when they say the law, that's what they're referring to is all of the law, including the Sinai. So I'm talking about like family members of mine who have gone to like Protestant churches now. That's what they use.
So I'd go back to this verse and say, does that make any sense?
Right.
It has to be something different. It has to be something different that was added to what was given to Israel at Mount Sinai. Those laws, that Torah, the Torah of the covenant, not the book of the law that was added. So, to me, that helped clarify some things for me, because it makes sense then. This was something that was added. It was a crutch. It was a prosthesis given to them to get them until the time that Messiah would come, until Shiloh would come and repair these issues. By what? By the new covenant, right? He paid that sacrifice of Yahweh and his representative walking between the pieces. Abraham didn't walk between the pieces. So if Abraham's descendants violated it, Yahweh was on the hook. One of the reasons the Messiah had to come and pay that penalty was because he's fulfilling the covenant that Yahweh made with Abraham and the walking through the pieces. He was Yahweh's representative to die for Yahweh, if you want to say, since he's the one who took that burden on at the pieces. So it's one of the main reasons he had to come. You also get into the whole issue of the... So remember Ruth married Boaz, and what is he called? He was called the kinsman redeemer. And Yeshua is called the kinsman redeemer because he's also acting in that role on that regard as well. He's acting for us, the people that he wants to save from sin. He's paying the penalty. Galatians 3:2, "And the law is not of faith, but the man that doeth them shall live in them." What law are we talking about? The book of the covenant or the book of the law? I would argue you're talking about the book of the law, because remember what Israel said. All that Yahweh has spoken, we will do. To me, that's a faith statement. They're accepting the covenant. They're saying, all that you have instructed us, all that you say, we will do. But the book of the law was enjoined upon them. They didn't get a vote in that one necessarily, other than if they didn't follow it, it'd be killed. I'm not going to go through all this. Hebrews 10, 1 through 8, if you want to put that in your notes, read through that. Again, it's talking here. I think we talked a little bit about this, about the sacrifices that were done year after year. Can't take away the sin. What law is that out of? That was out of the book of the law. The Levitical ordinances where they would do these offerings year after year after year. Now, yeah, there's offerings given at the holy days and things too. You could say those are year after year. Deuteronomy 28, 15 and Deuteronomy 29, 21, it says, but it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of Yahweh the Elohim to observe to do all the commandments and his statutes, which I command you this day, these are all the curses that shall come upon thee and take thee, overtake thee. And then again, it talks about according to all the curses of the covenant that are written in the book of the law. This is speaking in the book of the law and not the book of the covenant. Because why? You can look through Exodus 19 through Exodus 24. There's no curses. Save maybe this one. Where it says about the engraving, no making no graven images. If you bow down and serve Elohim, will visit the iniquity of the fathers upon the children of the third and fourth generation. That's kind of the only curse you find in the book of the covenant. But we know in the book of the law, there's a whole bunch of, it's like a half of one whole chapter in Deuteronomy that talks about all the different curses that will be upon them. Now, he does talk about blessings if they do certain things, but there's really no curses given except maybe this. We talked earlier about the Passover, how in Exodus 12, the Passover was sacrificed by each of the heads of the households. But after that, under the book of the law, that was taken away and was done by the priests. We also, here's another one, circumcision. We know circumcision was the sign of the covenant given to Abraham, right? And that the Israelites were supposed to do that. But then we read in Deuteronomy, or no, actually when we get into Joshua, that for the 40 years that they were roaming around in the wilderness, none of the newborn people were, none of the men were circumcised. Why not? Because I would offer that they'd broken the covenant, the sign of the covenant being circumcision. They were not a part of that anymore. They were now going to be put under the book of the law. And as part of the book of the law, circumcision was again part of that. That one's I'm kind of trying to decide about. Because you read a lot about what Paul says in the New Testament about not, you know, that it, the circumcision and the uncircumcision, it doesn't matter. Because it's a spiritual circumcision. It's a spiritual circumcision of the heart that really matters. Yahweh came into covenant with Abraham because of his heart. He wasn't physically circumcised, though, until much later. Who presided over the Passover the year that Yeshua was killed? Any thoughts?
Which one?
In Scripture, in the New Testament, the year that the Messiah was killed, who presided over, for the people, who presided over? Okay, what was his name? You remember?
Caiaphas?
Yeah. Okay. That's what I thought. That kind of seems what Scripture represents. Let's go to Matthew 26, 61 to 66. It says, and said, this fellow, this is where Yeshua is before the Sanhedrin, before the high priest, and they're trying to get people to bear false witness against him. It says, and said, this fellow said, I'm able to destroy the temple of Elohim to build in 3 days. And the high priest arose and said unto him, answerest thou nothing? What is which these witnesses are against you? And it says, and Yeshua held his peace. He didn't respond. But then notice what happens. And the high priest answered and said unto him, I adjure thee by the living Elohim that you tell us whether thou be the Messiah, the son of the living Elohim. And then Messiah responds. Well, why is he now responding? He wasn't responding. He was silent in front of Herod. He was silent in front of Pilate for the most part. He was silent in front of him. He adjured him by the name of Elohim. And Yeshua said unto him, thou hast said, nevertheless, I say unto you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power, coming in the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest rent his clothes, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. What further need we have of witnesses? Behold, now you have heard this blasphemy. What think you? And they answered, he's guilty of death. I really find this interesting. Kind of humorous, actually. Because, as we talked about, Leviticus 5 says, if a person hears the voice of swearing and is a witness, whether he's seen or known of it, if he doesn't utter it, then he shall bear his iniquity. So when the high priest says to him, I adjure you by the living Elohim, Messiah had to respond. Because under the Torah, if he didn't respond, he'd be held guilty of his sin. But what's sort of humorous is Leviticus 10:6. It says, and Moses said unto Aaron and to Eleazar and to Ithamar, his sons, uncover not your heads, neither rend your clothes, lest you die. There's another place in Torah that talks about rending your clothes. If the high priest rent his clothes, he was to be killed. But then you read up in Matthew that the priest said, we should kill him, Messiah. They should have been taking the high priest out and killing him under the Torah. So if the high priest, who was active at the time, basically took away his priesthood from himself, who was left who could have presided over the Passover? The Messiah. From the time that John mikvahs him in the water in the Jordan, he becomes in that position. He's filling that role then. And he's really the one who can legitimately oversee the Passover. And of course, we know where he goes to the tree, everything that happens according to prophecy, according to what had to happen, and when it's all done, he says it is finished, and he gives up the ghost. You may disagree, but by Torah, Caiaphas should have not been presiding over the Passover. A couple of ending thoughts. Again, we talked a little bit about Ephesians 2 already, 11 through 13. Wherefore, remember that you being in times past, Gentiles in the flesh were called uncircumcision, but them which is called circumcision in the flesh made with hands, that at the time you were without Messiah, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise. What covenants of promise is that referring to? I think it goes back to the covenant he made with Abraham, in Genesis 12 and Genesis 15, what he offered to the Israelites, and then now in the new covenant, the covenants of promise, again, based on basically what Abraham had, but now as the Messiah, he's making even better under the new covenant. Again, 1 Timothy 3:16, all scripture is given for our benefit to use. Again, just because maybe some of the book of the law issues were not under anymore, they're still valid for us, they're still important for us to learn from. And they, Matthew 5:17, they don't go away. There's things for us to learn from. Are we under the administration of a Levitical priesthood? Obviously, right now we're not. There is no temple. There are those who say, you know, they're descended from the Levitical priests. But for us, as we see in the book of Hebrews, Messiah is under our Melchizedek priesthood. And then we have to ask the question, what priesthood are we of? I'm just going to finish. I think that's my last one. David had an understanding of this. This is in 1 Chronicles 16:1-7. If you want to put that in your notes, I'm not going to read through all of this. This is the event where he brought the tabernacle down to the pool of Siloam, and they brought the Ark of the Covenant in. This was before the temple was built. And he gives this psalm, and he goes on and prays here. We'll pick it up in verse 11. Seek Yahweh and his strength. Seek his face continually. Remember his marvelous works that he hath done, his wonders, and the judgments of his mouth. O ye seed of Israel, his servant, the children of Jacob, his chosen ones. He is Yahweh our Elohim. His judgments are in all the earth. Be mindful always of his covenant, the words which he commanded to 1,000 generations, even of the covenant which he made with Abraham, and of his oath unto Isaac, and hath confirmed the same to Jacob for a law, and to Israel for an everlasting covenant. David understood the importance of the covenant that was made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And talking about it as an everlasting covenant, understood then Messiah's role of restoring that. And what we now see, as mentioned, was in Jeremiah, the new covenant. It's also mentioned in the book of Hebrews. So these are the covenants of promise that were given, that we mentioned earlier. So that's all I got. I know it's a lot. I wanted to give a couple of references. I've got two books here if you're interested in studying this. Both of these are written by a guy by the name of David Perry. One is The Covenants of Promise, and the other one is Back to the Melchizedek Future. I would also say, if you get out on YouTube, there's a website, it's called Torah to the Tribes. And the teacher on there, his name is Matthew Nolan. And he also speaks about this. There's actually a few other people who are doing that, but I found between his writings and Matthew's verbal teachings are really good on that. They're both kind of in sync on both of those things. Yes, sir?
Also, there's a website called Creator's Covenant.
Right.
That addresses this as well, and that's I've been reading his stuff for a couple of years. It's a very, very good website about this very topic.
Yeah.
Creatorscovenant.org, I believe it is.
So, again, I've been studying into this. You know, as you said, I've looked at some of this in the past, but I think these books and the videos from like Matthew Nolan, Toward the Tribes and stuff, helped me to really get a deeper understanding of what was going on here. And again, if you're interested, I'd be glad if anybody's got any questions or thoughts. But again, look into it for yourself. I mean, I'm still looking to it. This is a huge topic. And then you may say at the end of the day, John, well, what difference does all this make? What does it mean for me? Well, I think it's important for us, for a few reasons, to understand some of the scriptures when we have people coming to us and saying, well, all the law is done away. Now you can kind of see that Paul, what he was referring to, was, is it Book of the Covenant or Book of the Law? It also, I think, establishes us, if we are Israel, right, we're returning back to what Israel was supposed to have. We're supposed to be a nation of priests. We're supposed to have a priesthood. And that's, as I showed at the beginning, in three or four different scriptures, maybe five different scriptures in the New Testament, the Book of Revelation. So it should help us understand these covenants of promise, and as part of that, our role as priests, we now have to say, we can't wait until the kingdom gets here. We need to be acting in that role now. So what does that mean? What does that look like for us to be priests, priests of the kingdom? Because that is what we're asked to be. That is what our role is supposed to be. So I think that's pretty important. So that's all I got, unless anybody's got some questions, some thoughts. That'd be fine. All right. Well, I appreciate the opportunity. I'll have these books back by me if you want to come and take a look at them or take a picture of them so you'll have what they look like. And I appreciate the opportunity. Hopefully I didn't bore you to death. Some of you are probably more interested in this topic than others, but thank you.